Well, hi, this is Dave. Welcome, everybody. How are you?
Hi, Dave.
Hey, welcome. It's great to have you here. I know that one or two more are going to be joining us, and one late registrant, and I hope she got the dial-in number just a few minutes ago, actually. Let me just make a couple of introductory remarks, and then I want to spend some of our time today having each of you introduce yourselves, and then I'll tell you kind of the plan I have, and I emphasize that I want to remain open for input and suggestions. I'll save a portion of our time at the beginning and at the end of each of the seminars to have a discussion, to look at what kind of questions or challenges you have, and if you have cases that you begin to apply or think about things in this way, to talk about the cases, and I welcome that. I think it's a great way that we can apply some of the tools and methods and principles and think about coaching in the system. So first, let me say a couple of things about a couple of bonuses I have in mind. You'll see in the curriculum, and I sent the curriculum in PDF to a couple of you who registered late because I wanted you not to get behind and to have it, because it'll take a couple of, more than a couple of days. It'll take 5 or 6 days for my fulfillment house to send it to you. So you have the PDF. You'll notice, and those of you who have the curriculum already, you'll notice that there are sections that are in gray. Those are the sections that are in the client workbook. Those are the introduction and the ending and the all the glossary and that sort of thing, as well as the sections in gray, are all peeled off to be in a client workbook in case you want to work with clients individually or in groups using the workbook and having certain kinds of things. And you'll see the 28-week protocol is one way of doing that, to have a certain assigned portions of the workbook in a systematic way each time that you then have a group that discusses. I've done that three or four times with people actually who have done the training, like you are, who have wanted to do a group and have it set up where they would do the exercises themselves and then meet as a group and talk about it. It was a dynamite group. So I know it works in a group, because I had avoided doing that for a long time, to think of having any kind of template or anything that you apply. That just seemed rigid to me. But then I kept hearing that people wanted a way, if they had a client who wanted to work that way or thought it would be applicable, to do that. So that 28-week protocol is there for that. And you'll be, I'm going to gift you each with a copy of the workbook at the end of the training. I'm going to have my fulfillment house send you a copy of the workbook, so you'll see how it looks and feels and how it might be for a client. And that's the workbook. When you complete this training, you're licensed and specialty certified, that you can co-brand and put your name on the cover, put your message as a new first page, contact information, and that sort of thing. Now, this will all go, we'll go over all this again, because I know it's a lot of information in the beginning. And I hope that makes sense about how it's organized. And I put it in gray in the curriculum to kind of align with suggested uses. In other words, there's the roadmap system, the 7 steps to deconstruct a story and understand how to construct a new one. There are exercises and work pages for each of the steps. Not that you'll want to go through that in order with a client, but just so you'll have some kind of conceptual framework. Another thing I'm going to send you, I'm going to be sending you some things along, not to inundate you, but just as they occur. One is a copy of Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual after a revision I'm making. And I have some marketing pieces and a synopsis of how to develop your mentor coach story that I'm completing, that I'll send to you about midway, because we don't spend much time on marketing or the business aspects. Now, we can talk about that in the discussion, but this is really more about the system of coaching that we have. And I have quarterly mentor groups with a white paper for all of the graduates of New Life Story and New Money Story Mentor, and I'll invite you for the quarterly mentor group that will be the first Monday in November at 1 Eastern. You'll get a schedule of all this stuff as we unfold here, but just to keep in mind, that's something that I do ongoing for people who maintain their license and that sort of thing. Now, any questions or clarification about this or any housekeeping, and then I want to do introduction because I'm much more interested in hearing you guys talk than me. Any questions or clarification?
Yeah, Dave, this is Jen.
Hi. Hey, Wolf, how are you? Go ahead.
I was wondering, for today's reading, the notes to the mentor and the introduction, is the notes to the mentor in the binder?
It's in the curriculum, yes.
The curriculum
I'm referring to is Live a New Life Story, The Owner's Guide. It's like a 345-page it's in a loose-leaf binder so that we can add stuff to it if you want to. And that's the portion I'm talking about that is in gray that is the client workbook. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Great. Super. Any other questions or clarifications? Well, let's start with introductions. If you would just give us an idea of your journey to arrive here for our collaboration and some notion of what you're doing in coaching and what you'd like to use our work and our collaboration for. Tisha, would you begin, please?
Sure. So my name is Tisha Ford, and I am a certified life coach. However, I am not practicing as fully or wholeheartedly as I'd like to. That's part of what brought me here. But I do. I actually have another job, which takes up a lot of my time. But my goal, which is again part of the reason why I'm here, is to start to build in a more formal way, build a practice. I find, even though I'm not practicing as a life coach professionally and on a regular basis, I find that I naturally end up falling into that coaching client type of dynamic, and which I guess is what brought me to life coaching in the first place a few years back when I became certified. And it just seems as though now is a good time for me to start to spend a little more time focusing on creating a stronger practice for myself. And what specifically brought me to this particular program is the notion of story has become a prominent part of my own personal work. And what I guess I mean by that is really looking at what is real versus what is story that I'm creating for myself, especially self-limiting story. And then being creative with the notion of how I can transform, especially the negative stories, and into some sort of a positive and more progressive plan for myself. So when I saw this course being offered, it just seemed like perfect timing, and thus I signed up, and now here I am.
That's great, and you gotta tell us a little bit about your current work. I'm excited about that, and I'd like to hear a little more about it.
Oh, sure. So I am currently working for the NFL. I work in the events department, and I've been here for about 9 years, actually. I can't believe it. And really, my main focus, I'm actually kind of an island unto myself in my department. Although I'm in the events department, I'm really more focused on business development and special projects. So basically, I oversee the Super Bowl bid process, currently working on Super Bowl 2018, actually, believe it or not. I also oversee a diversity procurement and business development program that's focused on working with businesses, minority women-owned businesses in each Super Bowl region. And that's a pretty extensive program. I work with businesses in each region, anywhere from 300 to 500 businesses per year. And then I also manage the host committees, our future host committees. So right now I'm working with three of them, And then I also work on the development of special projects, new events and programs, et cetera. So that gives you a sense of what I do.
That's great. Well, that's exciting. Thank you very much. Super.
Thank you.
And I mentioned that because I'm secretly planning a comeback. Okay, Terry, what would you tell us about you?
I'm sorry?
Terry, would you tell us about you?
Yes, I will.
What you'd like to get out of our collaboration together and what you do as a coach.
Okay. This really resonated with me, this particular coach or this particular class. I had gotten my original coach certification a little over a year ago, and I don't have a coaching practice per se, and yet I do. I own and operate a ballroom dance studio, and I work with training a lot of staff, and I also obviously teach.
I'm sorry, let me interrupt you. I'm very sorry. We have two Terrys, and I know this is not the Terry I have down first. Terry.
Oh, I apologize.
So this is Terry Holmes.
Apologize.
Would you?
Yes, it is.
All right, this is Terry Holmes. Terry, take it away. Go ahead.
Do you want me to continue?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh,
I'm
sorry,
clear now.
David.
You've been clear all along. I'm finally clear, and I wanted to be sure everybody else was, too.
Okay, I apologize. I
no, that's
didn't
my fault.
Know which Terry you were asking.
I've forgotten we have two Terrys.
Okay. Anyway, my coaching work originally, what interested me was because I work with a lot of students and have... Although I teach ballroom dancing, most people don't come to this for that purpose. They come for some other missing in their lives. And I felt that there was a lot of coaching that I was doing, relationship coaching, life coaching, that sort of thing. And I just wanted to complement what I was already doing and also in training my staff. And when I saw this program being advertised, it really resonated with me because so many of my clients are in that space of, you know, wanting to create a new story, a new life, something they've always wanted to do that they're not, you know, pursuing what's real for them. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Now, that's fascinating. They come to your dance studio and ostensibly take ballroom dancing, but they're really wanting to create a new story for themselves.
Yes.
That's fascinating. At what point do you see this transition? Are there certain nodal points like retiring from one career or a midlife issue? What transition points do you see, or what changes do you see crystallizing and catalyzing the transition and the transformation that you're aware of?
Most times it is some kind of major life event that brings people to us. But there are also, we have people who I have always wanted to do this, and it's on my bucket list, and I'm doing it now. You know, I'm going to step up and do this.
Yeah.
Everything from, you know, from divorce to midlife crisis to, and, you know, oftentimes we'll have people come in, and they're just starting off in their life, and they see that this is a way for them to develop conflict resolution skills, to ultimately have a better marriage long term, and they want to be proactive in that.
That's very interesting. You'll see in the curriculum that the seminars will correspond. We're going to spend one entire seminar on career, on new career story, on career transition, and another on relationship. So some of the things that you're experiencing may be very useful for us to look at there as we look at some of the aspects of change and transition as people create new stories. So that's going to be a fascinating application, and I'm eager to hear your input there. So thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good. Now, do you plan to have a coaching practice that's part of what you do and develop that a bit more, or just use the tools and methods and principles in what you already do?
A little bit of both. David, I'd really like to transition into doing more coaching, but I find that I keep getting, life keeps putting me in a place where I need to use it with what I'm doing. When I try to step away and do it, create my coaching practice as just that, a coaching practice without the dance piece, somehow things occur, the universe doesn't cooperate with that. So it keeps putting me back into the dance space. And I do utilize all of the knowledge a lot in my dancing, so perhaps that's where it's meant to go.
And I think the way you said that is really interesting, and I think one of the best ways that we can be of most benefit to our clients is to really know our own story quite well. And I think you've said some things that are particularly important in terms of constructing your story, and we're going to learn more. And you'll see in the curriculum that even though working with clients and training, teaching, mentoring, and coaching use different languages, the language I'm trying to use in the curriculum is to say you, and I'll do that in the seminars, to say you as if you were speaking to a client, but you know I'm talking to you, but that's our first focus, is to look at and understand your own story, because then you're in the best position to help a client develop their story told in their voice. So
sure.
That's the best instrument we have, is to really develop our own. So thanks very much. That's great.
Thank you.
Now, Dr. Terry Finney, would you introduce yourself? Or we may wait a little bit. Are you unmuted?
Yes, I'm unmuted.
Welcome.
Sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm a psychologist. I have 3 degrees in psychology. I have a doctorate degree in psychology. I got in 1991. I've done a lot of work with attorneys and judges, a lot of forensic psychology. Over the past few years, I have backed away from some of the forensic work, largely because of the trauma that I end up having to read about and see and be a part of. And I had an event in my own family that also kind of made me want to back away from trauma. So a few years ago, I started kind of reinventing myself and circled back to my undergraduate work, was also in business. So started integrating, and I'm still working on integrating kind of my coaching, consulting, collaboration with families of wealth and advisors and people who work with money issues. It's kind of a long sentence, and it's probably more complex, but I think that's kind of the short story.
Okay, well, that's terrific. And where do you see yourself evolving in terms of coaching? Is it developing that coaching, consulting, collaboration with families of wealth more?
So I would like to do more coaching than I'm doing now. I'd like to continue building that. And I'm going to be working with, hopefully in collaboration, in partnership with other people who have different skill sets. So I anticipate that I'll be doing more training, more workshops, more teaching. And the one thing that I'm really good at that I want to get better at, and I think this is going to be helpful, is I'm pretty good at helping people kind of solidify their sense of self. And I do that a lot with people who are in transition, like out of sports into life. And I see a lot of 20-somethings who come out of college and they have this degree and they think a job is going to fall from the sky, and then it doesn't. So I help them find their way, and I'm looking forward to like being able to integrate what I know from different kind of learning arenas into like just a more integrated, more focused kind of practice.
Terrific. Well, thanks very much. I think each of you can already see how excited I am with the quality of people and experiences who are part of our group, and I think that makes so much difference, and I'm really excited about our group and both the diversity and the depth and the quality of personal, professional experiences and accomplishments. I think we're in for a treat. Jennifer.
Yeah, hi, Dave. Hi, everyone. I am Jennifer Powers and a professional coach and speaker, and I've been doing so independently for 8 years now, and I also am an author of O-Shift, which has been quite fun, and then recently co-authored O-Shift for Teens with my partner and husband, partner now husband. So I, as a life coach, I work a lot with people on various parts of their lives, and I do find that one of my favorite questions is around the story that they're telling themselves or challenging them on the belief that they have. And I think Tisha was saying earlier, it's sort of like the limiting beliefs. And so when I think about life story and helping people better understand that, I know I can be doing that better in my coaching, and I'm pretty sure, Dave, if anyone can teach me how to do it, it's you, to better extract like the story that they're telling themselves, and then helping them to see what's true, what's really true, as opposed to what their perception of the truth is. And so I look forward to honing those skills and bringing more rich material and a richer approach to my coaching. And as far as what I hope, but that's what I hope to get out of it. And I'm also a huge fan of you, Dave, so I wanted to be around you.
Well, I think the reason that Jennifer says that is that she tolerates any insertions I have in our faculty meetings. Jennifer's a little bit modest here. She's been a faculty member of Coast Training Alliance, a mentor trainer at CTA for some time now, and I'm honored to have her here, and I'm excited about collaborating at this level with each of you and with Jennifer. So this is,
this is
a treat for me. And that means, Jennifer, if I decide to take 3 or 4 weeks off, then you'll handle the class, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
With pride.
Okay, well, welcome. That's great.
Don't do that, Dave.
Okay. Amy.
Hi, yes, I actually am on mute. I'm not going to be able to talk at this time, but perhaps you can call on me in a bit when I don't have children in the car with me. I'm actually waiting in the carpool line, quietly listening in, very excited to get to know all of you, but perhaps you could call on me in just a little while.
Absolutely. That sounds good.
Thank you.
Okay. That's great. A couple of other things I want to mention. You'll see that each of the modules is a complete unit as well as being a component of a 10-part series. The first session, we're going to be talking about how we construct stories and some ideas and notions about stories that we'll build on. And then we're going to spend the next 4 seminars on modules 1 through 3, which are the 7 steps. And these are the 7 steps to deconstruct the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. So this is really some nuts and bolts about how to understand how we can listen to stories and help someone look at revising them or creating new ones, beginning with our own stories. So this is simply looking at this process more closely, and then in the subsequent seminars we're going to apply it to specific storylines that we write or that we'll be hearing with clients from career, money, wellness, relationship, and that sort of thing. So in the first 5 sessions you'll hear me talk a little bit more than subsequent sessions and presenting more material in the curriculum you have, but I want to spend, as I mentioned, beginning and end of the seminars, 10 or 15 minutes at the beginning and the end, talking about questions, discussions, your case presentations. I'm going to have a portion in the middle where I extend and apply the material. And I want to leave it as an open line. In other words, not put it on lecture mode so that at any time you can interrupt me and ask for a clarification or have a question. So it will be more seminar-like, even though there's a bit of material that I want to cover in addition to what you have in the curriculum. I'm not going to reiterate anything in the curriculum, but really extend it, apply it, look at case material and applications in a practical way to give you more of a way of at least one perspective of working. And this is an agreement that I have with every client who I work with, a kind of rule of engagement that I request, that I be able to interrupt that client at any point in case there's a coachable moment, something that I want to freeze frame or have us look at instead of doing the socially appropriate thing and waiting 3, 4, or 5 paragraphs later and then coming back, because there are probably other coachable things in between. And that's an agreement that I request of them, and I totally give them permission to interrupt me at any time if there's something I'm saying that doesn't quite make sense or that we need to explore a bit more. So that's the rule of engagement I'd like and I'd like to offer for each of you. So don't hesitate to interrupt. Just one or two more things I want to mention. There's going to be, just so you'll have a heads up, not that we have to spend any time on it now, but there's a registry. It's a listing of all graduate, specialty certified, licensed New Life Story coaches on my site. I do a good deal to promote that for individual as well as corporate referrals. And I think you'll hear with the people as we begin to have discussions who you may want to refer to here, because I think that's the best way to get referrals is to give them. And there's a whole group of people, and as you know, most of the people, most all the people who do this training are people who have been specifically invited to me, people whose work I know and respect. So the group of people who are trained in this way are a very select group, and I think, you know, the people of all the coaching community who really come to understand how to integrate psychology, neuroscience, quantum physics with strategic coaching to include mind and brain with behavior to make changes at last. So one other thing I want to mention. Instead of Coach the Coach, because we have 12 seminars, 75 minutes each, so there's not really a time for formal Coach the Coach, but I do two things. One is encourage you to bring cases or vignettes or things that are challenges that you'd like to discuss, because it can benefit all of us. The other thing, instead of Coach the Coach, I would like to have each of you do a 750 to 1,000 word write-up of a coaching case using the roadmap format. And now this write-up can be on yourself, it can be on a client, it will be confidential. And I'd like in later seminars to spend about 15 minutes for each of you to present and then for us to discuss. And if you'd like to volunteer a time to commit to a particular seminar, that'd be great. If not, I'll do an assignment. And I'd like to complete this before the last class so that we complete these by seminar 11. And I'm going to send you a sample of one write-up to give you an idea. And you don't even need to worry about this or think about this until we get through the first 5 seminars, when you have a real feel for the roadmap process and you hear some discussion of this. So this is just some guideline, but I think it can add to the richness of our discussion to have each of you do a brief write-up. And that's in lieu of any kind of exam or coach the coach or anything else. So any thoughts or questions before we move into our first seminar? Okay, well, don't hesitate as we get going. So in this first session, we're going to talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new story. The remaining seminars will look at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change beginning with the roadmap process. We'll talk about your life story. I encourage you to do the exercises and the work pages in the workbook. I want to encourage you to actively listen and understand your own story to apply the process. When you've done it yourself, you're in the best position to coach it. When you've made your own journey really visible to yourself, you can best guide the client's journey. And this is, and I'm sure you've heard this before, from a Chinese proverb, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. And from Columbia University, remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. So, my encouragement, put it into action. Here's a question I'd like you to write down. And to schedule perhaps a brief brainstorming session with yourself. And here's the question. What's my story? Now, think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Maybe bullet your major storylines. Now, this is not your bio, your title, your role. It's your story. One of the things you bring as professional coaches that's unique, you're experts at change, choice architects. You facilitate and guide a client's life, a wellness story, our money story, our relationship story. As we go through the seminars, think about your professional story. This is the piece that I'm working on that I'll complete to send you a copy of about your mentor coach story. Work on how to convey your unique offering in a clear, brief, simple way that focuses on client benefits. At a meeting recently, I heard David Plouffe, Obama's chief campaign strategist in his first campaign, say, be able to answer every crucial question in one sentence. And Einstein said, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. So here are some premises that our work together will be based on. One, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the outline of life narratives, the core assumptions of life stories that inform what people look for and how they attribute meaning to what they experience. Behavioral patterns and belief systems downloaded, especially from parents and important others in the first years of life, become automatic to operate without observation or awareness. Neuroscientists estimate that about 90 to 95% of our operating systems, our behaviors and core beliefs, are pre-programmed in the unconscious mind and operate on autopilot. We see the derivatives, the behaviors, and the manifest actions that people take, but they may not be aware even of their operating system and the beliefs and the assumptions that generate those behaviors. In fact, one of the people I collaborated with not too long ago put it very succinctly. This is an internationally known guru and publisher, and he said, you know, Dave, I don't know how to tell my money story to myself in order to know what to change. And that was just a very succinct way, because it's a challenge to tell your story to yourself in order to know what to change. So, since we have an operating system that's by and large unconscious, we create two stories simultaneously. One is the surface story. We run our lives with conscious intentions and aspirations. And this includes, this is what I want from life. These are my intentions, my goals. Yet, this conscious processor is only in charge of about 5 or 10%. The unconscious story that ghostwrites behaviors at times in a different direction from the conscious intention can create a stuckness or an impasse. And an example is, well, I want to create a much bigger income and I want to generate wealth. But then the shadow story says, well, I don't really believe I have what it takes, or you know, making a lot of money is unspiritual, or any number of things that can counter that without fully being aware of it. Two, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand, how we make sense of things, how we remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, you know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. It makes things make sense. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. We personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer relationships and assign causality. And think about how much we do that and how much, and we'll talk about this more in a later seminar, about how our minds and our brains are really striving to bring closure and end dissonance, which creating cause and effect does that, whether or not it's accurate. Three, we each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and then how we process it. The brain needs a story. It will infer one, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists awareness of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. We then create life narratives according to that plot, since mind and brain are both programmed to process in a default mode to ignore facts that contradict assumptions. If it doesn't fit our belief system, we probably don't even notice it. We'll return to each of these and elaborate in practical coaching terms. Four, a life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions, in other words, tell us what to look for and then how to perceive and process our experiences once they're downloaded. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. An example, Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently the Broadway hit Wicked, said, "You know, I didn't even realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent. Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. After his 23rd book, he for the first time became consciously aware that, as he put it, I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, the mother's still there. What's the problem? There's nothing to write about." Five, we believe and remember only that which fits our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. Someone abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships or current ones, even though circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by a narrative plot. Our expectations not only help us see, but they determine what we see. But it may blind us to other things that we don't happen to be looking for. A really simple example, a professor who's fond of telling stories asks his class, close to the end of class, if they have time for him to tell them a story before they leave. They look at their watches and inevitably say yes, because they love his stories. Then he immediately asks them what time it is. Every person in the class, at least those who had a watch, looked at their watches again. Now, this is completely understandable because their frame of reference for the initial checking of their watches was to see how much time remained, not the time that it was. They were looking at something different. The first time they looked to see if there was enough time left, when we look for one thing, we may miss another. Six, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an illustration. This is a true story, happened a number of years ago out of Oxford. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, though essentially identical, ape colonies to live and observe for a year, not communicating with each other. They were chosen because of their remarkable similarity of personality, philosophy, training, education. They entered the ape colonies, lived for a year, and then emerged to compare results. And while they expected remarkable similarities, they found incredible discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a unity and comfort with the apes, a real harmony, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, was always like right on the cusp of a conflict, never reached a harmony. They couldn't figure out or understand these really discrepant results or find any reasons whatsoever. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally, sort of by accident, found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun instead had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, knowing this fact, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. Seven, a A story can define possibility. I hope each of you have seen the outline as well as the syllabus at the page you were sent to when you registered, have downloaded the outline. I've put a fairly detailed outline so you wouldn't have to do a bunch of writing, so you got just kind of listen and see if any of this makes sense to you and if you agree with any of it. And you guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. In 1954, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Within the following 18 months, 12 other people broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. And today this is commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. 8. A story can define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient is prescribed an inert pill plus some expectations, a story. In the vast majority of cases, the story becomes the reality. By anticipating an experience, we can create it. In fact, a story generates a truth so powerful it even, in most cases, reverses the actual pharmacological effect of a real medicine when the story is directly opposite the actual pharmacological effect of a real medicine. People go with the story there too, create the story. Now, the placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that becomes a truth. In fact, a recent MIT study showed that the more expensive placebo works significantly better than a much cheaper one. You know, same placebo, different stories. And now, this isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. And in a related way, medical research suggests that just over 70% of successful non-surgical treatments are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. Now, this is almost always, in my view, the result of the physician's belief that the treatment will work. 9. A story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates is then perceived to act on its creator. Here are some ways that we can see ourselves as the victims of the stories that we create rather than as the author. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. Every one of these to me is a coachable moment, because how someone constructs their expression tells us exactly how their mind works. And when they see themselves as the victim of their feeling rather than the author of it, that is a very coachable moment. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations, not just the stock market. Here's another really simple example of the power of story. A woman I knew who recalled an incident a long time ago from her adolescence. She attended a Catholic all-girls boarding school. She said, at one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked, and everybody got drunk. 10. Your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. And there's in the glossary, those of you who already have the curriculum, there's a listing of many of the terms that we're going to be using, and a fuller explanation. It's basically an excuse for me to put a couple of my favorite quotes, because I love to collect quotes, and you'll see some of my favorite quotes there. There is an entry for self-statements, and it's alphabetical, so you may want to look at some point at that. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. We're going to spend the time in one of the seminars looking at this in more detail in terms of how to coach you around it and with it. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. Everyone is always making self-statements. So as a coach, we know not to take it personally. We listen carefully, but we also hear it as the self-statement of the client. And that's why it's important to put your ego in a blind trust, to not take it personally and listen to the client. client's story, not inserting yourself or taking it personally. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves, to make themselves feel better for what they want or don't want to own. They'll gladly give you what they don't want to own, what they disavow or project. And you can never hit your own stride if you're running somebody else's race. So this is some of what we're going to listen for and talk about is when someone speaks, how much ownership of are they taking in their story. And a client then is always showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. So if you think about it that way, rather than seeing it as resistance, it can help you understand how to engage. Because when a client is showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her, they're doing their job description. Now, that may be to annoy you, but that's why everybody and the board of directors or the executive suite referred that client to you, because that person is on their way out at that company unless they find some way to you know, tweak their social and emotional intelligence. So guess what? They're going to be doing the same thing with you that they do with everybody else, and you're going to be in a position to be the only person in that person's life who can possibly help them in terms of creating a different story, revising the story that they're in, and automatically engage with people. 11, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation that I just mentioned came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. And we know how true it is in the intersubjective space of two people who create a third, which is the coaching relationship. 12, an authentic belief, and this is huge, an authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. Now, this one comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known this for centuries. We'll talk about how that works and how to work it. But this is why I believe the most important thing that we can do with a client is to believe in that client. And that's why I work only with clients in whom I believe. Because when we believe in someone, it activates their brain to create a state of mind that is more creative and synthetic and integrative. Now, let me pause for a minute. Any thoughts or questions? Now, each of these points are ones that I've raised here are themes that we'll return to, develop, and weave together throughout our experience. So let's look at a practical application here. Why do we resist change? Even changing a story that doesn't work. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? And everybody knows the most important things in terms of exercise, of diet, of saving for the future, of relationship, people know exactly what to do, but they don't do it. Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work? Maybe even do it harder and expect a different result, kind of like talking to somebody who doesn't understand English and repeating it in louder English, is if that's going to work. Even when it leads to lower energy, death, plateaued careers, maybe even disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb asks in the book The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or uncomfortable. It's just familiar, and that's probably a better term for it, is zone of familiarity. It's a default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. Let's do a brief exercise. If you have a headset, great, but if you have a handheld, if you can tuck it between your chin and your shoulder so that your hands are free. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers very firmly. Now, get a good feel for that. Notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly as they are, firmly clasped together, but change so that your other thumb is on top. Now, how does that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now, move the thumb back to the original position. Kind of a relief, probably. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante. Add significant success or significant stress, like a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We'll talk more about comfort zones and how to use this awareness to help someone program change, because there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Now, the other part of this answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He was a mischievous little guy. He intentionally created a really circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns, and he noticed that every person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn, despite it being really circuitous. Not one person started a new, more direct route, and he increasingly got more diabolical, more twists and turns, so that every person still followed the path of resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. Now, to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight? Exactly what we do as mentor coaches. New information or a new context. That's what we're experts at. And we're going to talk about this juncture in particular when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engaging new behavior. The newness, the uncertainty, can read as evidence not to proceed, or intuition of a wrong choice, or if it's read correctly, as a signpost of change and progress to be reframed in that way. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located very close to the emotional center of the brain that says this isn't normal when we try something new. And that adds to this uncertainty because the brain wants to stay on the superhighway of the familiar even if it doesn't get you to where it's going. The travel is great. It's easy. It's familiar. And literally, when you try something new, you're taking a machete and creating a pathway in a new area, and it's work. And you're not certain about where it is, and you're continuously uncertain every step of the way. And the error detection mechanism says this isn't right, so it's a real challenge. Now, not only do we actively construct stories, but our brain continually edits at the same time. So we're going to talk about how to use this mechanism, this error detection mechanism, as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Now, an example is a classic study, and I'm sure you've seen this probably on the internet, in which an audience is asked to watch several people dribbling and passing a basketball among themselves. Their job, to count the number of passes each person makes during a one-minute period. Intense concentration is needed because the ball moves really quickly. Then, someone dressed in a gorilla suit crosses the floor, walks through the players, turns to the viewer in mid-screen, thumps his chest, and leaves. How many people saw such an obvious phenomenon? Researchers Daniel Simons and Christopher Chambers found that consistently, just slightly over 50% of people failed to see the gorilla. They didn't even register it. This inattentional blindness is our brain at work trying to construct meaningful and consistent narratives according to our story, and the story there was count the number of passes, from an inconsistent world. Things that don't fit the storyline get unconsciously edited or simply fail to register as relevant. Now, listen for the power of story here. Your brain can rewire. Your mind software can be revised. New experiences practiced consistently form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. So, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. This is also from the Black Swan. Ideas come and go. Stories stay. Now, just to highlight active choice, I'm going to describe a study. Now, a couple of you have heard this from me before if you've done things in different contexts. I want to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behaviors, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about business, talk about sport. They would choose one of those options and then behave according to that assignment for the entire day. So an introverted person, for example, would act as an extrovert for an entire day if that was that choice. Now, additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something twice a week that they had never eaten before, and they would read something twice a week that they had never read before. What's your guess about the biggest change in this group? Any guesses? Take a wild guess.
They became happier.
That was an epiphenomenon, exactly. So that's very true. Any other guesses? Now, the remarkable finding, remarkable to me, was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. Now, 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off, most continued to lose weight. And this had nothing to do with the diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. The rationale? When people were urged to change routine behavior, to focus on the process of change and choice, it made them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. Now, in coaching, I'd call this story busting. When the participants process decisions actively, they exercise choice. So, in other words, when they were conscious of choosing what they ate, they became very aware of that choice, not just the default mode of eating, but of the choice. They even became, most of them, became very aware that every bite I take is a choice. And they began to ask, is this choice in my best interest? And think about, isn't that what we hope to help a client do? To look at the active process of choosing. And a premise here for our work is, whatever we think and feel and experience is what we actively create each moment. So being aware of the choice of exactly what we think and feel and experience can be very useful for us and for our clients. And it's not there until someone creates it. Once becoming actively aware of making choices, you can decide then what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. So if you want to understand something, try to change it. Now, here's a brief example from an executive mentor coaching session I had. Brian, a guy I'll call Brian, was working successfully at his new CEO position. 3 months earlier, he advanced from COO at another corporation. He was doing a great job in his first 100 days. One session he departed from, and we had been working together maybe 4 to 5 months at this point, one session he departed from our discussion of success strategies to say that he had a fear that he was going to somehow sabotage his new achievements. He then said that he regularly stopped at a convenience store to eat candy before he got home so that his wife wouldn't see him. And this had started after he'd been a CEO. So he recognized this was goofy behavior, and he finally confessed it to me. I asked how he decided to stop each time. He responded by calling it sneak eating, since he hadn't told his wife. And since he didn't answer my question, I ask again, what do you say to yourself the instant you decide to stop and sneak eat? Well, he wasn't sure, and I knew that. It was something he was automatically. So I pressed. I wanted to know specifically the conversation he was having with himself the instant, the frame before he decided to stop, because he had already told himself he wasn't going to stop, but then at some point he said, no, I'm going to stop. So I wanted to know what the frame was immediately before when he decided, I'm going to stop. He said he wasn't sure. He hadn't thought about it. Well, I knew that because he was doing it so automatically. An impulse fuses urge with action to collapse that contemplative space where reason resides. So I wanted to restore that space. So there was no place in that for what's in my best interest. It was just automatic. So I propped it. I still wanted to isolate that frame before you decided, that instant of decision. So I said, in other words, do you bargain with yourself to say, well, I'll do better later or I'll stop it next week? Or do you oppose your own authority to say, well, I'll do whatever I want? Or do you feel some overwhelming urge that hijacks your best judgment? And he stopped me and said, I get it. I get what you want. He recognized a conversation with himself that went, you know, to hell with it. I've been in charge of stuff all day. I'm going to eat whatever I want, and nobody's around to stop me. He realized that the result was to abandon his own principles. I noted that in the story he was writing, he farmed out his authority to his wife as if she were the obstacle. He kept the other half, the desire, as if he were getting away with something. He created the illusion that he triumphed because she didn't see him. We touched in on his stress in being a more ultimate authority now than he had ever been in his life, his first CEO position. He acknowledged his choice to not be, for at least an instant, his own authority. So his question when we discussed this was, well, how do I get it back? And I said, the question really isn't how you get it back, but how do you not give it away? It's yours. You're the author of the story. Somebody's liking this story. Just manage the background noise, mute star 6 so that we can keep it open. I paused and then I said, it seems like you're not being loyal to yourself. He recognized that he was writing a storyline that he actually detested. And then we had a discussion then about how he could convert his concern into an intention that was in his best interest, how he could take care of himself and have all of himself going in the same direction and have effective strategies for eating and exercise just as he did in his business. And we could then apply this process, this choice architecture, to expand his success in his company as well as in his life. So now in closing, here are some principles that focus on facilitating change. These are kind of a preface to looking at Live a New Life story or any of the storylines. One, each person's life story is created. In adulthood, you create whatever you think, feel, and experience each moment. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on it, even though it may seem at the time to be just the way things are, the default mode. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Now, I borrowed that and got permission to borrow that from an old codger who was an alcohol counselor on a service that I ran way back. And he was so right. He was so practical in that. Three, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome, which is why we ask somebody, what would you like us to focus on this session? And then ask them to create the success map to say, what would you like to walk away from the session today with? This establishes the beginning of a sense of effectiveness and mastery. This is the antithesis of someone telling you what to do. We're going to talk more about this later, but here's just a preface. Whenever someone has an aha moment, a moment of insight, three different parts of their brain light up, and they're vaulted to a different state of mind that's more synthetic and integrative, and they're able to be more creative. Now, here's what happens when they're given information, a fact, a directive, an instruction, nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. Four, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Assumptions manifest as feelings and behaviors. When you make assumptions explicit, you can more clearly see which facilitate and which interfere, which work and which don't. Five, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that creates most problems. Six, small change leads to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue in order to specify progress, a next step to shrink the change. You know, for example, and this is the bread and butter what you guys do each day. For example, when you feel overwhelmed with the amount of tasks, first clarify one issue that if done today would be progress, that you can create traction. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. Seven, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. To resolve a problem, even emotionally, to come to the end of the past does not create a blueprint for success. This is why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. Strategic plans for specific goals are necessary. In other words, to purge your computer of all the software, get rid of the old, outdated software, but you don't exactly have an operating system. You don't have new software to operate on with unless you install it. If something is totally a new experience, you may need a guide, even for something like a healthier diet or exercise. Eight, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. Nine, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. The end should be in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well and really succinctly. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take? She asked. Where do you want to go? Responded the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. 10. You need the correct paradigm. This is something we're going to return to because I don't think we talk about this enough in coaching. A paradigm is an internal map, the way you see, interpret, and understand something. It needs to be correct. If you're in Dallas and need to navigate the city, a map of Houston is useless no matter how hard you try. And it needs to be current, not a paradigm from an old story. 11. Decide what you want. Believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception. Just like the filter on a camera alters the image that gets recorded in the camera. And as I mentioned, we now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on or turn them off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are only limited to the ones we allow ourselves to see. So I want to close with just one brief story, an example of a belief coupled with a goal. A destitute young housewife had almost no money. She could not afford a babysitter or even a computer, but she had a story to tell, and she was determined to do it, so she decides to write. As soon as she starts writing, her mother dies at age 45 from multiple sclerosis. Her marriage to an abusive husband ends in a divorce. She has a miscarriage. She gets fired from her job and lives on government welfare. She takes her baby to a coffee shop in the middle of the afternoon and writes on a yellow legal pad while her baby takes a nap. She does this every day, 7 days a week, for 4 years. And then, after much work, she finally found a publisher for her story, for Harry Potter. Okay, we don't have as much time as I'd hope we had for discussion, but I'm interested in your thoughts and reflections, clarifications, in our remaining time. We've got about 5 minutes. How does this grab you? What are your thoughts and questions?
This is, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. This is Terry Finney. I apologize for the dog. I thought I was muted. She was excited. I'm very excited. I can't wait to dive into this book. And I really, I love and appreciate the intentionality that went into using the metaphor of roadmaps and travel and pathways. And I love the metaphor and all that that I think makes possible.
You know, the backstory on that is this was originally my next book, back a number of years ago. And, you know, I had my wife, my second wife, we met at a writer's conference, and she looked at some of the manuscript. And she said, this really needs to be a training for coaches. And I said, and she said, these steps, she said, answer this question in one sentence, which I've passed on to a number, almost everyone I've trained, because if I have to suffer at it, I'm going to pass it on. What are the steps that someone, needs to take to live a new life story? Because it was, basically the title of the training curriculum. And I said, you'll have to read the book. No, if it's of any use to people, it has to be in a stepwise way. What are the steps someone takes? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So months and months later, I could answer that question, and I realized that it was something that needed to be not a book, but a training. So this is where we are, and this is how we got there. And then I saw the acronym that kind of jumped out to me, that this is roadmap, and these are the specific steps. So that's how this came about. It started out somewhere different, but it ended up in a more systematic way of looking at how to help someone do it, and in a training rather than a book for public consumption.
Well, I think it's great.
Other thoughts or questions? I'm interested in your take, each of you. And how does this fit with your assumptions about what we'd be doing? I know this is just a general introduction so far, but
yeah, this is Jen. Dave, yeah. I'm really excited because it's a surprise to me how much I'm going to actually benefit on a personal level.
Oh, you thought you were going to get away with just talking about clients, huh?
Yeah.
Hey, nice try.
Yeah. So I'm like freaking giddy about this because, the universe works in crazy ways. It comes, like, things come to you. I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe that I get to this at this very time. And then you use some examples about, like, eating and weight and body image and all that, that whole story. I am right in the thick of that. So for me to be able to learn this for my clients but also to benefit for myself is really, really exciting. Great timing.
And thank you. I'm excited too. And a really good example of that is 95% of people who diet gain back their weight, and usually 1 to 2% more. Why is that now? I believe it's because they don't change their story. They don't change their software. They change their behavior, but they don't change their software. In other words, their body image. They don't revise their body image and their story of their relationship to food. So 95% gain it back. And that's the seventh step. The P on roadmap is program new identity, because whenever we work with someone in coaching, if we don't help them revise the model that they're using along with the behavior, they're going to revert back to the old story, because the most powerful force of the human psyche is that we return to our identity. And unless that identity evolves and changes, then they're going to revert back to their old behavior and not make changes. So that's why this is so powerful, and what we do is so life-changing, is that we change something as bedrock, as fundamental, as someone's identity of how and who they see themselves to be.
Yep. What a gift.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have just another minute. Any other quick comments? Well, if you'll get me, those of you who haven't sent me a bio, I really want to get those out so that you'll see in a more formal way the excitement I have about the quality that people get me. Just a brief 2 or 3 paragraph bio in the body of an email, and I'll send those out. And if there are any questions in between time, be sure and email me. If you think of examples or questions or clarifications or anything from your cases, bring them to the beginning of our discussion next time, and we'll start right there. So thanks very much. I'm really excited, and we're off and running. See you next week. Oh,
thanks, Steve. Yeah.
One thing that I'm sorry, I forgot to mention this, and I didn't put this in the syllabus. Next week we will not meet. I'm going to be doing a keynote and a workshop seminar at a national meeting, and I'm going to be away Monday and Tuesday. I'll get out a note about this. We're going to skip next week, and then we'll be back. I think for 11 weeks straight after that. And I'm sorry, I almost forgot to mention that. So we'll meet in 2 weeks. So you'll all have a chance to get your problem, that sort of thing. So thanks very much.
Great. Thank
bye
you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You.
Thank
bye.
You.
Bye.
Thank you.